The Shining Ones, The Tomilly, Book 2, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 82. Sparhawk moved in rather quickly at that point. Afriel was coming very close to saying things that she shouldn't be saying in the presence of the others.
"Shall we move right along?" he suggested quite firmly. "Vanyan's right, Afriel, and you know he is. If Rebal finds out that we're here, we'll have to wade through his people by the score."
"All right." She gave in quite suddenly.
"That was quick," Talon said to Khalad. "I thought she was going to be stubborn about it."
"No, Talon," she smirked. "Actually, I'm sort of looking forward to hearing that vast cry of chagrin that's going to echo from every mountain in Derisia when our enemies hear the sound of Annika's fist closing around Belium again. Just lean back in your saddles, gentlemen, and leave the rest to me."
Sparhawk awoke with a start. They were riding along the brink of a wind-swept cliff, with an angry sea ripping itself to tattered froth on the rocks far below. Sophrenia rode in the lead, and she held flute and folded in her arms. The others trailed along behind, their cloaks drawn tightly around them, and wooden expressions of endurance on their faces. The wind had risen, and it pushed at them and tugged at their cloaks. There were some significant impossibilities involved here, but Sparhawk's mind seemed somehow numb to them. Normally, Vanyan rode protectively close to Sophrenia, but Vanyan didn't seem to be with them now. Tinian, however, was. Sparhawk knew with absolute certainty that Tinian was 1,000 leagues and more away, but there he was, his broad face as wooden as the faces of the others, and his right shoulder as functional as ever. Sparhawk did not turn around. He knew that another impossibility was riding behind him. Their horses plodded up the winding trail that followed the edge of the long ascending cliff toward a rocky promontory that thrust a crooked, stony finger out into the sea. At the outermost tip of the promontory stood a gnarled and twisted tree, its streaming branches flailing in the wind. When she reached the tree, Sophrenia reined in. Kirik walked forward to lift flute down. Sparhawk felt a sharp pang of bitter resentment. He knew about Afriel's need for symmetry, but this went too far. Kirik set Afriel down on her feet, and when he straightened, he looked Sparhawk full in the face. Sparhawk's squire was unchanged. His features were rugged, and his black beard, touched with silver, was as coarse as ever. His bare shoulders were bulky, and his wrists were enclosed in steel cuffs. Without so much as changing expression, he winked at his lord.
"Very well, then," Flute said to them in a crisp voice. "Let's get on with this before too many more of my cousins change their minds. I had to talk very fast and even throw a few tantrums to get them to agree, and many of them still have grave doubts about the whole notion."
"You don't have to explain things to them, Flute," Kirik told her in that gruff voice of his,
a voice so familiar that Sparhawk's eyes filled with sudden tears.
"Just tell them what to do. They're church knights, after all, so they're used to following orders they don't understand."
She laughed delightedly.
"How very wise you are, Kirik. All right, then, gentlemen, come with me."
She led them past the gnarled tree to the brink of the awful precipice. Even though they were very high above it, the roaring of the surf was much like heavy thunder.
"All right," Afriel told them. "I'm going to need your help with this."
"What do you want us to do?" Tinian asked her.
"Stand there and approve."
"Do what?"
"Just approve of me, Tinian. You can cheer if you'd like, but it's not really necessary. All I really need is approval, and love, of course. But there's nothing unusual about that. I always need love."
She smiled at them mysteriously. Then she stepped off the edge of the cliff. Talon gave a startled cry and plunged after her. The child goddess, as unconcerned as if she were only taking a morning stroll, walked out across the empty air. Talon, however, fell like a stone.
"Oh, bother!" Afriel exclaimed peevishly.
She made a curious gesture with one hand, and Talon stopped falling. He sprawled in midair, his limbs spraddled, his face pasty white, and his eyes bulging with horror.
"Would you take care of that, Sophrenia?" the little girl said. "I'm busy right now."
Then she glared down at Talon.
"You and I are going to have a talk about this young man," she said ominously. Then she turned and continued to walk out toward the open sea. Sophronia murmured in Styric, her fingers weaving the spell, and Talon rose with a curious fluttering movement, flaring from side to side like a kite on a taut string, as Sophronia pulled against the force of the gravity that was trying to dash him to the rocks below. When he had reached the edge of the cliff again, he scrambled across the wind-tossed grass on his hands and knees for several yards, and then collapsed, shuddering violently. Afriel, all unconcerned, continued her stroll across the emptiness.
"You're getting fat, Sparhawk,"
Kyrick said critically.
"You need more exercise."
Sparhawk swallowed very hard.
"Do you want to talk about this?"
he asked his old friend in a choked voice.
"No, not really. You're supposed to be paying attention to Afriel right now."
He looked out at the child goddess with a faint smile.
"She's showing off, but she's only a little girl after all, so I guess it's sort of natural."
He paused, and a note of yearning came into his voice.
"How's this lady been lately?"
"She was fine the last time I saw her. She and Elis are both living on your farm, you know."
Kyrick gave him a startled look.
"A slady thought it would be best. Your sons are all in training now, and she didn't think it made much sense for her and Elis to both be alone. They adore each other."
"That's fine, Sparhawk,"
Kyrick said, almost in wonder.
"That's really fine. I always sort of worried about what was going to happen to them after I left."
He looked out at the child goddess.
"Pay close attention to her now, my lord. She's coming to the hard part."
Afriel was far out over the surging waves, and she had begun to glow with a brilliant incandescence. She stopped, hardly more than a glowing spark in the distance. "Help her, gentlemen," Sophronia commanded. "Send all of your love to her. She needs you now." The fiery spark rose in a graceful little arc, and then shot smoothly down through the murky air toward the long, lead-gray waves rolling ponderously toward the rocky shore. Down and down she plunged, and then she cut into the sea with no hint of a splash. Sparhawk held his breath. It seemed that the child goddess stayed down for an eternity. Black spots began to appear before the big Pandian's eyes.
"Breathe, Sparhawk,"
Kyrick barked, bashing his lord's shoulder with his fist.
"You won't do her much good if you faint."
Sparhawk blew out his breath explosively, and stood gasping on the brink of the precipice.
"Idiot,"
Kyrick muttered.
"Sorry," Sparhawk apologized.
He concentrated on the little girl, and his thoughts became strongly jumbled. Afriel was out there beneath those endlessly rolling waves, certainly, but Flute was there as well, and Danae. That thought cut at his heart, and he felt suddenly icy cold. Then that glowing spark burst up out of the sullen water. The child goddess had been an incandescent white when she had made her plunge, but when she emerged from the sea, she glowed a brilliant blue. She was not alone as she rose once more into the air. Belium rose with her, and the very earth seemed to shudder with its reemergence. All glowing blue, Afriel returned toward them, bearing that same golden box Sparhawk had cast into the sea a half dozen years ago. The little girl reached solid ground once more. She went directly to Sparhawk and held up the gleaming golden box.
"Into thy hands, for good or for ill, I deliver up the Belium once more, Annika," she intoned formally, placing the box in his hands.
Then she smiled an impish little smile.
"Try not to lose it again this time," she added.
Chapter 6.
"He looked well,"
Khalad said in a tight, controlled voice. "Aren't you being just a little blasé about all this?" Talon asked his brother.
"Did you want me to go into hysterics?"
"You saw him then?"
"Obviously."
"Where were you? I couldn't see you around any place."
"Lord Vanyan and I were right over there,"
Khalad replied, pointing toward the far side of the trail.
"We were told to just keep quiet and watch. We saw you all come riding up the hill.
Why did you jump off the cliff like that?
I don't want to talk about it.
Sparhawk was not really paying very much attention to the others. He stood holding the golden box in his hands. He could feel the bellium inside, and, as always, it was neither friendly nor hostile. Flute was watching him closely.
Aren't you going to open the box, Annika?
Why? I don't need bellium just now, do I?
Don't you want to see it again?
I know what it looks like.
Isn't it calling to you?
Yes, but I'm not listening. It always seems to complicate things when I let it out, so let's not do that until I really need it.
He turned the box over in his hands, closely examining it. Kurik's work had been meticulous, though the box was unadorned. It was just that, a box. The fact that it was made of gold was largely irrelevant.
How do I open this? When I need to, I mean. There isn't any keyhole.
Just touch the lid with one of the rings.
She was watching him very closely.
Which one?
Use your own. It knows you better than Aelana's does. Are you sure you don't feel some sort of...
Some sort of what?
Aren't your hands aching to touch it?
It's not unbearable.
Now I see why all the others in my family are so afraid of you. You aren't anything at all like other humans.
Everybody's different in some ways, I suppose. What do we do now?
We can go back to the ship.
Can you get in touch with the sailors?
Yes.
Why don't you ask them to sail across the gulf and pick us up somewhere on this side? That way we won't have to ride all the way back to Jorson again, and we'll be able to avoid any chance meetings with Reball's enthusiasts. Some of them might be sober enough by now to recognize the fact that we're not Edomishmen.
You're in a strange humor, Sparhawk.
I'm a little discontented with you at the moment, to be honest about it.
What did I do?
Why don't we just drop it?
Don't you love me anymore?
Her lower lip began to tremble.
Of course I do. But that doesn't alter the fact that I'm put out with you just now. People we love do irritate us from time to time, you know.
I'm sorry, she said in a contrite little voice.
I'll get over it. Are we finished here? Can we mount up and start back?
In just a moment, she said, seeming to suddenly remember something.
Her eyes narrowed and began to glint dangerously.
You,
she said, leveling a finger at Talon.
Come here.
Talon sighed and did as he was told.
What did you think you were doing?
She demanded.
Well, I was afraid you'd fall. I wasn't the one who was going to fall, you clot. Don't you ever do anything like that again.
Talon could have agreed with her. That would have been the simplest way, and it would have avoided an extended scolding. He did not, however.
No, Flute, I'm afraid it's not going to be that way. I'll jump in every time I think you're in danger.
He grimaced.
It's not really my idea. I want to be sure you understand that I haven't completely lost my mind. It's just that I can't help myself. When I see you do something like that, I'm moving before I even think. If you're really serious about trying to keep me alive, don't do things like that when I'm around, because I'll try to stop you every single time, regardless of how stupid it is.
Why? She asked him intently.
I guess it's because I love you.
He shrugged. She squealed with delight and swarmed up into his arms.
He's such a nice boy, she exclaimed, covering his face with kisses.
They had gone no more than a mile when Calton reined in sharply, filling the air with sulphurous curses.
Calton! Vanyan snapped. There are ladies present. Take a look behind us, my lord, the blonde Pandian said.
It was the cloud, inky black, ominous, and creeping along the ground like viscous slime. Vanyan swore and reached for his sword.
That won't do any good, my lord, Sparhawk told him.
He reached inside his tunic and took out the gleaming box.
This might, though.
He wrapped the band of his ring against the box lid. Nothing happened.
You have to tell it to open, Sparhawk,
Flute instructed.
Open,
Sparhawk commanded, touching the ring to the box again. The lid popped up, and Sparhawk saw the bellium nestled inside. The sapphire rose was perfect, eternal, and it glowed a deep blue.
It seemed strangely resentful, as Sparhawk reached in and lifted it out, however.
"We all know who we are," he told the stone and its unwilling inhabitants. "I'm not going to speak to you in Trollish, because I know you can understand me, no matter what language I use. I want you to stop this nonsense with that cloud, and I want you to do it right now. When I turn around to look, your little patch of private darkness had better be gone. I don't care how you do it, but get rid of that cloud."
The sapphire rose grew suddenly hot in his hand, and it seemed almost to writhe against his fingers. Flickers of red, green, orange, and purple, all interspersed with streaks of white, stained the azure petals of Belium, as the troll gods trapped within the gem fought to resist. Belium, however, appeared to exert some kind of over-control, and those ugly flickers were smothered as the jewel began to burn more brightly. Then there was a sudden violent jolt that numbed Sparhawk's arm to the shoulder.
"That's the way," Carlton shouted with a sudden laugh.
Sparhawk turned in his saddle and saw that the cloud was gone.
"What happened?" "It sort of flopped around like a fresh-caught eel," Carlton laughed again. "And then it flew all to pieces. What did you do, Sparhawk? I couldn't hear what you said."
"I let our blue friend and its tenants know that the cloud was starting to irritate me. Then I sort of hinted at the fact that I get ugly when I'm irritated."
"They must have believed you."
Flute was staring at Sparhawk in open astonishment.
"You broke all the rules," she accused him.
"I do that sometimes. It's quicker to cut across the formalities once in a while."
"You're not supposed to do it that way."
"It worked, didn't it?"
"It's a question of style, Sparhawk. I'm technically in charge here, and I don't know what Belium and the troll gods are going to think of me after that."
He laughed, and then gently put Belium back into its box.
"Nice job," he told it. They were going to have to work together after all, and a little encouragement now and then never hurt.
Then he firmly closed the lid.
"It's time for some speculation, gentlemen," he said to the others. "What can we make of this?"
"They know where we are, for one thing," Talon offered.
"It could be the rings again,"
Sophronia noted.
"That's what happened last time. The cloud and the shadow were concentrating on Sparhawk and Aelana right at first, because they had the rings."
"Belium's closed up inside the box," Sparhawk said. "And so are the troll gods."
"Are they still inside the jewel?" Ulof asked him.
"Oh, yes," Sparhawk said. "I could definitely feel them when I took Belium out."
He looked at Afriel, phrasing his next question carefully. There were still some things that needed to be concealed.
"I've heard that a god can be in more than one place at the same time."
He left it a little tentative.
"Yes,"
she replied.
"Does that apply to the troll gods as well?"
She struggled with it.
"I'm not sure,"
she admitted.
"It's a fairly complicated business, and the troll gods are quite limited."
"Does this box confine them in the same way that chainmail pouch did back in Zemok?"
She shook her head.
"It's different. When they're encased in gold that way, they don't know where they are."
"Does that make a difference?"
"You have to know where you are before you can go someplace else."
"I'll take your word for it."
He made a face.
"I think we may have blundered again," he said sourly.
"How so?"
Bevier asked him.
"We don't really have any absolute proof that the troll gods are in league with our enemy. If they're trapped inside this box with Belium and can't get out, they couldn't be, could they?"
"That was Gwarg in the mountains of Aton," Ulof insisted. "That means that he's out and about at least."
"Are you sure, Ulof? Those peasants around the bonfire were convinced that the big fellow in the ancient armor was in Cetes, too, you know."
"All the evidence points to it, Sparhawk. Everything we've seen this time is just like it was last time. And it was the troll gods then, wasn't it?"
"I'm not even positive about that anymore."
"Well, something had to have enough authority over the trolls to make them migrate from Thalesia to the north coast of Aton."
"Just how smart do you have to be in order to be a troll? I'm not saying that it was something as crude as the hoax Reball foisted off on those peasants, but..."
Sparhawk left it hanging.
That would be a fairly complex hoax, dear one,
Sophrenia murmured. But not quite impossible, little mother. I'll drop the whole line of thought if you tell me that what I'm suggesting is impossible.
Don't throw it away just yet, she said, her face troubled.
Afriel, Sparhawk said, will this gold box keep our friend out there from being able to locate Bellium?
She nodded. The gold shields it. He can't hear it or feel it, so he can't just move toward the sound or the sense of it.
And if I put Aelana's ring in there as well, would the box shield that too?
Yes, but your own ring's still out in the open, where he can feel its location.
One thing at a time.
He touched his ring to the lid of the box.
Open, he said.
The latch clicked, and the lid raised slightly. Sparhawk removed Aelana's ring from his finger and put it inside the box.
You look after it for a while, he told the Bellium.
Please don't do that, Sparhawk,
Vanyan told him with a pained look. Do what?
Talk to it like that. You make it sound like a real being.
Sorry, Vanyan. It helps a little if I think of it that way. Bellium definitely has its own personality.
He closed the lid and felt the latch click.
Ah, flute,
Khalad said a bit tentatively.
Yes.
Is it the box that keeps Bellium hidden, or is it the fact that the box is made out of gold?
It's the gold, Khalad. There's something about gold that muffles Bellium and hides it.
And it works on Queen Aelana's ring as well?
She nodded. I can't hear or feel a thing.
She stretched her open palm out toward the box Sparhawk was holding.
Nothing at all, she confirmed. I can feel his ring, though.
Put a golden glove on him. Calton shrugged.
How much money did you bring along, Sir Calton?
Khalad asked.
Gold's expensive, you know.
He squinted at Sparhawk's ring.
I don't have to cover his whole hand, he said. Just the ring itself.
I'll have to be able to get at it in a hurry, Khalad, Sparhawk cautioned.
Let me work on it. Does anyone have a gold florin? That would be about the right size.
They all opened their purses.
Calton looked around hopefully, then sighed. He reached into his purse.
You owe me a gold florin, Sparhawk, he said, handing the coin to Khalad. I'm in your debt, Calton, Sparhawk smiled.
You certainly are. One gold florin's worth. Shall we move on? It's starting to get chilly out here.
The wind had come up, gusty at first, but blowing steadily stronger. They followed the trail on down the slope, until they were riding along the upper edge of a long sandy beach, with the wind screaming and tearing at them, and the salt spray stinging their faces.
This is more than just a gale,
Ulloth shouted over the screaming wind.
I think we've got a hurricane brewing.
Isn't it too early for hurricanes? Calton shouted.
It is in Eosia,
Ulloth shouted back.
The shrieking of the wind grew louder, and they rode with their cloaks pulled tightly about them.
We'd better get in out of this, Vanyan yelled. There's a ruined farmstead just ahead.
He squinted through the driving spray.
It's got stone walls, so it should give us some kind of shelter from the wind.
They pushed their horses into a gallop and reached the ruin in a few minutes. The moldering buildings were half buried in weeds, and the windows of the unroofed structures seemed to stare down from the walls like blind eyes. The house had completely tumbled in, so Sparhawk and the others dismounted in the yard and led their nervous horses into what had evidently been the barn. The floor was littered with the rotting remains of the roof, and there were bird droppings in the corners.
How long does a hurricane usually last?
Vanyan asked.
A day or two,
Ulloth shrugged.
Three at the most.
I wouldn't make any wagers on this one, Bevier said. It came up just a little too quickly to suit me, and it's forced us to take shelter. We're pinned down in these ruins, you know.
He's right, Barrett agreed. Don't we almost have to assume that somebody's raised this storm to delay us?
Calton gave him a flat, unfriendly stare, a fair indication that he had not yet shaken off his suspicions about the young man and Queen Aelana's maid.
I don't think it's going to be much of a problem, Ulloth said. As soon as we get back on board that ship, we'll be able to outrun the hurricane.
Afriel was shaking her head.
What's wrong?
He asked her. That ship wasn't built to ride out a hurricane. As a matter of fact, I've already sent it back to where it came from.
Without even telling us?
Vanyan objected. My decision, Vanyan. The ship's no good to us in this kind of weather, so there was no point in putting the crew in danger.
It seemed well made to me,
Ulof objected.
The builders must have taken high winds into account when they designed her.
She shook her head. The wind doesn't blow where that ship came from.
There are winds everywhere, Flute,
he pointed out.
There's no place on this entire world where the wind doesn't blow now and...
He broke off and stared at her.
Where does that ship come from?
That's really none of your business, Sir Knight. I can bring it back after the storm passes.
If it passes, Colton added. And I wouldn't be at all surprised that when it does, this broken-down barn's going to be surrounded by several thousand armed fanatics.
They all looked at each other.
I think maybe we'd better move on. Storm or no storm, Vanyan said.
He looked at Flute.
Can you still... I mean, will this wind interfere?
It won't make it any easier, she admitted glumly. I don't want you to hurt yourself, Sophronia told her. Flute waved her hand as if brushing something aside. Don't worry about me, Sophronia. Don't try to hide things from me, young lady. Sophronia's tone was stern. I know exactly what all this wind's going to do to you. And I know exactly what trying to carry it around will do to our mysterious friend out there. Trying to chase us with a hurricane on his back will exhaust him far more than carrying 10 people on horseback will exhaust me. And I'm faster than he is. They don't call me the nimble goddess for nothing, you know. I can run even faster than Talon if I have to. Where would you like to go, Lord Vanyan? The preceptor looked around at them.
Back to Jorsen?
It's probably as good as any place in a hurricane, Colton said. At least the beds are dry.
And the beer is wet?
Ulof smiled.
That did sort of enter into my thinking, Colton admitted.
The wind shrieked around the corners of the building, but the inn was a sturdy stone structure, and the windows had stout shutters. Sparhawk chafed at the delay, but there was no help for it. Sophronia had put Flute to bed immediately upon their return to the inn, and she hovered over the little girl protectively.
She's really concerned, Vanyan reported. I guess there are limits after all. Flute's trying to make light of it, but I know exhaustion when I see it.
She won't die, will she? Talon asked in a shocked voice.
She can't die, Talon, Vanyan replied. She can be destroyed. But she can't die.
What's the difference?
I'm not sure, Vanyan admitted. I am sure that she's very, very tired. We shouldn't have let her do that.
He looked around the hallway outside the room where Sophronia was tending the weary little goddess.
Where's Colton? He asked.
He and Ulof are down in the tap room, my lord, Bevier replied.
I should have known, I guess. One of you might remind them that I won't go easy on them if they're unwell when we set out, though.
They went on downstairs again, and periodically checked the weather outside. If anything, the wind actually began to blow harder. Sparhawk finally went back up and knocked lightly on the door to Sophronia's room.
Could I have a word with Flute?
He asked when his tutor came to the door. No, absolutely not, she whispered. I just got her to sleep. She came out into the hallway, closed the door, and set her back protectively against it.
I'm not going to hurt her, Sophronia.
You can make safe wagers on that all over Deresia, she told him with a steely glint in her eyes. What did you want to ask her?
Could I use Bellium to break up this storm?
Probably.
Why don't I do that, then?
Did you want to destroy Jorsen? And kill everybody in town? He stared at her. You have no real idea of the kind of forces involved in weather, have you, Sparhawk?
Well, sort of, he said.
No, I don't think you do, dear one.
Whoever raised this hurricane is very powerful, and he knows what he's doing. But his hurricane is still a natural force. You could use Velium to break it up, certainly. But if you do, you'll release all that pent-up force at one time and in one place. You wouldn't even be able to find pieces of Jorsen after the dust settled.
Maybe I'd better drop the idea.
I would. Now run along. I have to keep watch over Afriel. Sparhawk went back down the hallway, feeling a little like a small boy who had just been sent to his room. Ulloth was coming up the stairs.
"Have you got a minute, Sparhawk?" he asked.
"Of course."
"I think you'd better keep a close eye on Kalton."
"Oh?"
"He's beginning to have some murderous thoughts about Barret."
"Is it getting out of hand?"
"You knew about it? About the feelings he has for your wife's maid?"
Sparhawk nodded.
"The more he drinks, the worse it's going to get, you know. And there's nothing else to do during this storm except drink. Is there any real substance to those suspicions of his?"
"No. He just pulled them out of the air. The girl's very, very fond of him, actually."
"I sort of thought she might be. Barret was already having enough trouble with the Emperor's wife without going in search of more. Does Kalton do this very often? Fall desperately in love, I mean?"
"So far as I know, it's the first time. He's always sort of taken affection where he could find it."
"That's the safest way," Ulloth agreed. "But since he's waited so long, this is hitting him very hard. We'd better do what we can to keep him and Barret apart until we get back to Mytherian and Aileen has the chance to straighten it out."
Khalad came down the hallway to join them. Sparhawk's squire had a slightly disgusted look on his face. He held up Kalton's florin.
"This isn't going to work, Sparhawk," he said. "I could cover the stone with it easily enough, but it'd probably take you a half hour to pry it open again so that you could use the ring. I'm going to have to come up with something else. You'd better give me the ring. I'm going to have to go talk with a goldsmith, and I'll need precise measurements."
Sparhawk felt a great reluctance to part with the ring.
"Can't you just..."
Khalad shook his head.
"Whatever the goldsmith and I decide on will have to be fitted anyway. I guess it gets down to how much you trust me at this point, Sparhawk."
Sparhawk sighed.
"You had to put it on that basis, didn't you, Khalad?"
"I thought it would be the quickest way, my lord."
Khalad held out his hand, and Sparhawk removed the ring and gave it to him.
"Thank you,"
Khalad smiled.
"Your faith in me is very touching."
"Well said," Ulloth murmured.
Later, after Sparhawk and Ulloth had carried Kalton upstairs and put him to bed, they all gathered in the common room for supper. Sparhawk spoke briefly with the innkeeper and had Sophrenia's meal taken upstairs to her.
"Where's Talon?" Bevier asked, looking around.
"He said he was going out for a breath of fresh air," Barret replied.
"In a hurricane?"
"I think he's just restless."
"Or he wants to go steal something," Ulloth added.
The door to the inn banged open, and the wind blew Talon inside. He was wearing doublet and hose under his cloak, and a rapier at his side. The weapon did not seem to encumber him very much. He set his back against the door and strained to push it shut. He was soaked through, and his face was streaming water. He was grinning broadly, however.
"I just solved a mystery," he laughed, coming across to where they sat.
"Oh?"
Ulloth asked.
"What would it be worth to you, gentlemen, to know Rebal's real identity?"
"How did you manage that?" Barret demanded.
"Sheer luck, actually. I was outside looking around. The wind blew me down a narrow lane and pinned me up against the door of the shop at the end. I thought I'd step inside to get my breath, and the first thing I saw in there was a familiar face. Our mysterious Rebal's a respected shopkeeper here in Jorsen. He told me so himself. He doesn't look nearly as impressive when he's wearing an apron."
"A shopkeeper?"
Bevier asked incredulously.
"Yes, indeed, Sir Knight. One of the pillars of the community, to hear him tell it. He's even a member of the town council."
"Did you manage to get his name?"
Vanyan asked.
Of course, my lord. He introduced himself just as soon as the wind blew me through the door. His name's Amador. I even bought something from him just to keep him talking.
What does he deal in? Barrett asked.
Talon reached inside his tunic and drew out a bright pink strip of cloth, wet and somewhat bedraggled.
Isn't it pretty? He said.
I think I'll dry it out and give it to Flute.
You're not serious, Vanyan laughed. Is that really what it sells?
May my tongue turn green if and it ain't, your preceptorship, the boy replied, imitating Kaalador's dialect. The man here in Edom who has all the tommels trembling in their boots is a ribbon clerk. Can you imagine that? And he collapsed in a chair, laughing uproariously.
How does it work? Sparhawk asked the next day, turning the ring over and looking at the underside.
It's the mounting of one of those rings people use when they want to poison other people's food or drink,
Khalad replied.
I had the goldsmith take it off the original ring and mount it on yours, so the cover fits over the ruby. There's a little hinge on this side of the mounting and a latch on the other. All you have to do is touch the latch, right here.
He pointed at a tiny lever, half concealed under the massive-looking setting.
The hinge has a little spring, so this gold cap pops open.
He touched the lever, and the half-globe covering the ruby snapped up to reveal the stone.
Are you sure that the ring will work if you're only touching Belium with the band? With that cap in the way, touching the stone to anything might be a little tricky.
The band does the job, Sparhawk replied. This is very clever, Khalad.
Thank you. I made the goldsmith wash out all the poison before we installed it on your ring.
The old ring had been used?
Oh, yes. One of the heirs of the Edomish noblewoman who'd previously owned it sold it to the goldsmith after she died. I guess she had a lot of enemies. She did at first, anyway.
Khalad chuckled.
The goldsmith was very disappointed with me. He really wanted to be alone with your ring for a while. That ruby's worth quite a lot. I didn't think Belium would respond to a piece of red glass, though, so I kept a close eye on him. You'd probably better find out if the ring will still open the box, just to be on the safe side. If it doesn't, I'll go back to the goldsmith's shop and start cutting off his fingers. After he loses two or three, he'll remember where he hid the real ruby. It's hard to do finely detailed work when you don't have all 10 fingers. But I told him I'd do that right at the outset, so we can probably trust his integrity.
You're a ruthless sort of fellow.
I just wanted to avoid misunderstandings. After we make sure that the ring still opens the box, you'd better take it to Flute and find out if the gold's thick enough to shield the ruby. If it isn't, I'll take it back to the goldsmith and have him pile more gold on that cap. We can keep doing that until it does what we want it to do.
You're very practical, Khalad.
Somebody in this group has to be.
What did you do with Colton's florin?
I used it to pay the goldsmith. It covered part of the cost. You still owe me for the rest, though.
I'm going to be in debt to everybody before we get home.
That's all right, Sparhawk,
Khalad grinned.
We all know that you're good for it.
That does it, Sparhawk said angrily after he had taken a quick look out the door of the common room.
It was 2 days later, and they had all just come downstairs for breakfast.
Let's get ready to leave.
I can't bring the ship back in this storm, Sparhawk, Flute told him. The little girl still looked wan, but she was obviously recovering.
We'll have to go overland, then. We're sitting here like ducks in a row, just waiting for our friend out there to gather his forces. We have to move.
It's going to take months to reach Matherion if we go overland, Sparhawk,
Khalad objected.
Flute's not well enough to speed up the trip.
I'm not that sick, Khalad, Flute said. I'm just a little tired, that's all.
Do you have to do it all by yourself? Sparhawk asked her.
I didn't quite follow that.
If one of your cousins happened along, could he help you?
She frowned.
Let's say that you were making the decisions, and he was just lending you the muscle.
It's a nice idea, Sparhawk, Sophronia said, but we don't have one of Aphriel's cousins along.
No, but we've got Belium.
I knew it would happen, Bevier groaned. The accursed stones unhinged Sparhawk's mind. He thinks he's a god.
No, Bevier. Sparhawk smiled. I'm not a god, but I have access to something very close to one. When I put those rings on, Bellium has to do what I tell it to do. That's not exactly like being a god, but it's close enough. Let's have breakfast, and then the rest of you can gather our belongings and get them packed on the horses. Afriel and I'll hammer out the details of how we're going to work this.
Chapter 7. The wind was screaming through the streets of Jorsum, driving torrents of rain before it. Sparhawk and his friends wrapped themselves tightly in their cloaks, bowed their heads into the wind, and plodded grimly into the teeth of the hurricane. The city gates were unguarded, and the party rode out into open country, where the wind, unimpeded, savaged them all the more. Speech was impossible, so Sparhawk merely pointed toward the muddy road that led off toward Korvan, 50 leagues to the north. The road curved around behind a low hill a mile or so outside of town, and Sparhawk reined in.
"Nobody can see us now," he shouted over the howling wind. "Let's try this and see what happens."
He reached inside his tunic for the golden box. Barrett came galloping up from the rear. "We've got riders coming up from behind," he shouted, wiping the rain out of his face.
"Following us?" Carlton demanded.
Barrett spread his hands uncertainly.
"How many?"
Ulath asked. 25 or 30, Sir Ulath. I couldn't see them very clearly in all this rain, but it looked to me as if they were wearing armor of some sort.
"Good," Carlton grated harshly. "There's not much fun in killing amateurs." "What do you think?" Sparhawk asked Vanyan.
"Let's have a look. They might not be interested in us at all."
The two turned and rode back along the muddy road a couple hundred yards. The riders coming up from behind had slowed to a walk. They were rough-looking men, wrapped in furs, and armed for the most part with bronze-tipped spears. The one in the lead wore a vast, bristling beard, and an archaic-looking helmet surmounted with a set of deer antlers.
"That's it," Sparhawk said shortly. "They're definitely following us. Let's get the others and deal with this."
They rode back to where their friends had taken some small shelter on the lee side of a pine grove.
"We stayed in Jorsum too long," Sparhawk told them. "It gave Rebal time to call in help. The men behind us are Bronze Age warriors."
"Like the Lamorks who attacked us outside Deimos?"
Ulath asked.
"Right," Sparhawk said. "These are most likely followers of Incites rather than Drichnoth, but it all amounts to the same thing."
"Could you pick out the leader?"
Ulath asked.
"He's right up front," Vanyan replied.
"That makes it easier then."
Vanyan gave him a questioning look.
"This has happened before," Sparhawk explained. "We don't know exactly why, but when the leader falls, the rest of them vanish."
"Couldn't we just hide back among these trees?" Sophrenia asked.
"I wouldn't want to chance that," Vanyan told her. "We know where they are now. If we let them get out of sight, they could circle back and ambush us. Let's deal with this here and now."
"We're wasting time," Carlton said abruptly. "Let's get on with it."
"Khalad,"
Sparhawk said to his squire,
"take Sophrenia and the children back into the trees a ways. Try to stay out of sight."
"Children?" Talon objected.
"Just do as you're told," Khalad told him. "And don't get any ideas about trying out that rapier just yet."
The knights turned and rode back along the muddy track to face their pursuers.
"Are they alone?"
Bevier asked.
"I mean, can anybody make out the one who might have raised them?"
"We can sort that out after we kill the fellow with the antlers," Carlton growled. "Once all the rest vanish, whoever's responsible for this is going to be left standing out in the rain all by himself."
"There's no point in waiting," Vanyan told them,
his voice bleak.
"Let's get at it. I'm starting to get wet."
They all pushed their cloaks out of the way to clear their sword arms, pulled on the plain steel helmets which had been hanging from their saddle bows, and buckled on their shields.
"I'll do it," Carlton told Sparhawk,
forcing his mount against Farron's shoulder. There was a kind of suppressed fury in Carlton's voice, and a reckless set to his shoulders.
"Let's go,"
he bellowed, drawing his sword. They charged. The warriors from the ninth century recoiled momentarily,
as the mail-shirted church knights thundered toward them with the hooves of their war horses hurling great clots of mud out behind them. Bronze Age weaponry and ancient tactics were no match for steel mail shirts and contemporary swords and axes, and the small, scrubby horses of the Dark Ages were scarcely more than ponies. Colton crashed into the forefront of the pursuers with his companions fanned out behind him in a kind of wedge formation. The blonde Pandian stood up in his stirrups, swinging his sword in vast, powerful strokes. Colton was normally a highly skilled and cool-headed warrior, but he seemed enraged today, taking chances he should not have taken, overextending his strokes, and swinging his sword much harder than was prudent. The round bronze shields of the men who faced him barely slowed his strokes as he chopped his way through the press toward the bearded man in the antlered helmet. Sparhawk and the others, startled by his reckless charge, followed him, cutting down any who tried to attack him from the rear. The bearded man bellowed an archaic war cry and spurred his horse forward, swinging a huge bronze-headed war axe. Almost disdainfully, Colton brushed the axe stroke aside with his shield and delivered a vast overhand stroke with his sword, swinging the weapon with all his strength. His sword sheared down through the hastily raised bronze shield, and half of the gleaming oval spun away, carrying the bearded man's forearm with it. Colton swung again, and his sword struck the top of the antler-adorned helmet, gashing down into the enemy's head in a sudden spray of blood and brains. The dead man was hurled from his saddle by the force of the blow, and his followers wavered like mirages and vanished. One mounted man, however, remained. The black-cloaked figure of Rebal was suddenly quite alone, as the ancient warriors who had been drawn up protectively around him were abruptly no longer there. Colton advanced on him, his bloody sword half-raised, and death in his ice-blue eyes. Rebal shrieked, wheeled his horse, and fled back into the storm, desperately flogging at his mount.
"Colton!"
Vanyan roared as the knight spurred his horse to pursue the fleeing man.
"Stop!" "But stay where you are!"
Still caught in the grip of that reckless fury, Colton started to object.
"That's an order, Sir Knight. Put up your sword."
"Yes, my lord," Colton replied sullenly, sliding his blood-smeared blade back into its sheath.
"Take that weapon back out,"
Vanyan bellowed at him.
"Wipe it off before you sheathe it."
"Sorry, Lord Vanyan. I forgot."
"Forgot? What do you mean, forgot? Are you some half-grown puppy? Clean that sword, Sir Knight. I want to see it shining before you put it away."
"Yes, my lord," Colton mumbled.
"What did you say?"
"Yes, my lord,"
Colton shouted it this time.
"That's a little better."
"Thanks, Vanyan," Sparhawk murmured.
"I'll deal with you later, Sparhawk," Vanyan barked. "Making him see to his equipment was your responsibility. You're supposed to be a leader of men, not a goat herd."
The preceptor looked around.
"All right," he said crisply. "Let's form up and go back. Smartly, gentlemen. Smartly. We're soldiers of God. Let's try to at least look as if we knew what we were doing."
There was some slight shelter from the wind back in among the trees. Vanyan led the knights through the grove to rejoin Sophrenia, Khalad, and the children. "Is everyone all right?" Sophrenia asked quickly.
"We don't have any visible wounds, little mother," Sparhawk replied.
She gave him a questioning look.
"Lord Vanyan was in fine voice,"
Uloth grinned.
"He was a little dissatisfied with a couple of us, and he spoke to us about it. Firmly."
"That will do, Sir Knight," Vanyan said.
"Yes, my lord."
"Were you able to identify whoever it was who raised that party?"
Khalad asked Sparhawk.
"No. Rebal was there, but we didn't see anybody else."
"How was the fight?"
"You should have seen it, Khalad," Barrett said enthusiastically. "Sir Colton was absolutely stupendous."
Colton glared at him. Sophrenia gave the two of them a shrewd look.
"We can talk about all this after we get clear of the storm," she told them. "Are you ready, Sparhawk?"
"In a moment," he replied.
He reached inside his tunic, took out the box, and commanded it to open.
He put on Ilana's ring and lifted the bellium out.
Here,
Sophronia said. She lifted flute, and Sparhawk took the little girl into his arms.
How do we go about this? He asked her.
Once we get started, I'll be speaking through your lips, she replied. You won't understand what I'm saying, because the language will be strange to you.
Some obscure Styric dialect?
No, Sparhawk, not Styric. It's quite a bit older than that. Just relax. I'll guide you through this. Give me the box. When Bellium moves from one place to another, everything sort of shivers. I don't think our friend out there will be able to locate Bellium again immediately. So if you put it and your wife's ring back in the box immediately and snap the cover down on your own ring, he won't have any idea of where we've gone. Now hold Bellium in both hands and let it know who you are.
It should know already.
Remind it, Sparhawk, and speak to it in Trollish. Let's observe the formalities.
She nestled back into the protective circle of his mailed arms. Sparhawk lifted Bellium, making sure that the bands of both rings were firmly in contact with it.
Blue Rose, he said to it in Trollish, I am Sparhawk from Alenia. Do you know me?
The azure glow which had bathed his hands, hardened, became like fresh forged steel. Sparhawk's relationship with the Bellium was ambiguous, and the flower gem had no real reason to be fond of him.
Tell it who you really are, Sparhawk, Flute suggested. Make certain that it knows you.
Blue Rose, Sparhawk said again, once more in the hideous language of the trolls. I am Annika, and I wear the rings. Do you know me?
The Bellium gave a little lurch as he spoke the fatal name, and some of the steel went out of its petals.
It's a start, he muttered. What now?
Now it's my turn, she replied. Relax, Sparhawk. Let me into your mind.
It was a strange sort of process. Sparhawk felt almost as if his own will had been suspended, as the child goddess gently, even lovingly, took his mind into her two small hands. The voice that came from his lips was strangely soft, and the language it spoke was hauntingly familiar, skirting the very outer edges of his understanding. Then the world seemed to blur around him, and it faded momentarily into a kind of luminous twilight. Then the blur was gone, and the sun was shining. It was no longer raining, and the wind had dropped to a gentle breeze.
"What an astonishing idea!" Afriel exclaimed. "I never even thought of that. Put the Bellium away, Sparhawk, quickly."
Sparhawk put the jewel and Ilana's ring back into the box and snapped down the cover on his own ring. Then he turned and looked toward the south. There was an intensely dark line of cloud low on the horizon. Then he looked north again and saw a fair-sized town at the bottom of the hill, a pleasant-looking town with red tile roofs glowing in the autumn sunshine.
"Is that Korvan?" he asked tentatively.
"Well, of course it is,"
Flute replied with an airy little toss of her head.
"Isn't that where you said you wanted to go?"
"We made good time,"
Uloth observed blandly.
Sophronia suddenly laughed. "We wanted to test our friend's stamina," she said. "Now we'll find out just how much endurance he has. If he wants to keep chasing us, he's going to have to pick up his hurricane and run along behind us just as fast as he possibly can." "Oh, this is going to be fun," Flute exclaimed, clapping her hands together delightedly. "I'd never have believed we could jump so far."
Colton squinted up toward the bright autumn sun.
"I make it just a little before noon. Why don't we ride down into Korvan and have an early lunch? I worked up quite an appetite back there."
"It might not be a bad idea, Sparhawk," Vanyan agreed. "The situation's changed now, so we might want to think our plans through and see if we want to modify them."
Sparhawk nodded. He bumped Farron's flanks with his heels, and they started down the hill toward Korvan.
"You seem surprised," he murmured into Flute's ear.
"Surprised? I was stunned."
"What did it do?"
"You wouldn't really understand, Father. Do you remember how the troll god Gnome moved you across northern Pelosia?"
"He sort of froze time, didn't he?"
She nodded.
"I've always done it a different way. But I'm more sophisticated than Gnome is. Bellium does it in still another way. Much simpler, actually. Gnome and I are different, but we're both part of this world. So the terrain's very important to us. It gives us a sense of permanence and location. Belium doesn't appear to need reference points. It seems to just think of another place, and it's there.
Could you do it like that?
She pursed her lips. I don't think so.
She sighed.
It's a little humiliating to admit it, but Belium's far wiser than I am.
But not nearly as lovable.
Thank you, kind sir. Sparhawk suddenly thought of something.
Is Danae at Matherian?
Of course.
How's your mother?
She's well. She and the thieves are very busy trying to get their hands on some documents that are hidden somewhere in the Ministry of the Interior.
Are things still under control there?
For the moment, yes. I know I've teased you about it a few times, but it's very hard to be in two places at the same time. Danae's sleeping a great deal, so I'm missing a lot of what's going on there. Mother's a little worried. She thinks Danae might be sick.
Don't worry her too much.
I won't, Father.
They rode into Korvan and found a respectable-looking inn. Uloth had a word or two with the innkeeper, and they were all escorted into a private dining room in the back, where the golden sunlight streamed in through the windows to set the oaken tables and benches to glowing.
"Can you keep anyone who might be curious from eavesdropping on us, little mother?" Sparhawk asked.
"How many times do you have to ask that question before you know the answer?"
she asked with a weary sigh.
"Just making sure, that's all."
They removed their cloaks, stacked their weapons in a corner, and sat down at the table. A squinty-eyed, slatternly serving girl came in and told them what the kitchen had prepared for the day. Sophrenia shook her head.
"Tell her, Vanyan."
"The lady and I, and a little girl, will have lamb," he said firmly. "We don't much care for pork."
"The cook ain't fixed no lamb," the girl whined.
"You'd better tell him to get started, then."
"He ain't gonna like it."
"He doesn't have to like it. Tell him that if we don't get lamb, we'll take our money to another inn. The owner of the place wouldn't like that very much, would he?"
The girl's face became set, and she stormed out.
"That's the Vanyan we came to know and love when we were boys," Colton laughed.
The fight that morning seemed to have improved his temper. Vanyan unfolded his map.
"We've got a fairly substantial road going east," he said, running his finger along the line stretching across the map. "It crosses Edom, and then goes on through Seneska. We'll cross the border into Tommel proper at Sarna."
He looked at Flute.
"How long a jump can Belium make at one time?"
"Would you like to pay a visit to the moon, Lord Vanyan?"
She frowned.
"There's a drawback, though. Belium makes a very distinctive sound when it does something. It probably doesn't even know that it's doing it, but it does sort of announce its location. We might be able to teach it how to conceal itself, but it's going to take time." "And that raises another point as well," Sophrenia added. "Sparhawk's holding Belium's power, but he doesn't know how to use it yet."
"Thanks," Sparhawk said dryly.
"I'm sorry, dear one, but you don't. Every time you've ever picked it up, either Afriel or I have had to walk you through it step by step. We're definitely going to need some time. We have to teach Belium how to be quiet, and we have to teach you how to use it without having someone hold your hand."
"I love you too, Sophrenia."
She smiled fondly.
"You're holding tremendous power in your hands, Sparhawk, but it's not of much use if all you know how to do is wave it around like a battle flag. I don't think we should rush back to Matherian immediately. That story you cooked up for Elana will explain our absence for at least 2 or 3 more weeks. We'll want to avoid the traps and ambushes our enemies are going to lay for us along the way, of course."
She paused.
"They might even be useful. They'll give you something to practice on."
"Jump around,"
Uloth grunted.
"Will you stop that, Uloth?"
she snapped at him.
"Sorry, Sophrenia. It's a habit of mine. After I think my way through something, I just blurt out the conclusion. The intermediate steps aren't usually very interesting. Our friends out there have been raising random disturbances to keep the Aetons running back and forth across the continent. Werewolves here, vampires there, shining ones off in that direction,
and antique armies in this. There's no real purpose to it all except to confuse the Imperial authorities. We could steal a page right out of their book, you know. They can hear and feel Bellium, particularly when it's doing something noisy. I gather that there's no real limit to how far it can jump at one time. So let's just say that Sparhawk wants to see what the weather's like in Darsus. He has Bellium pick him up by the scruff of the neck and drop him down in the square outside King Alberon's palace. He stays there for about a half hour, long enough for the other side to smell him out. Then he hops across the continent to Baressa in southern Arjuna and stays long enough to make his presence known there. Then he goes to Sarsos, then to Jura in southern Taconia, then back to Simura to say hello to Platymi. All in the space of one afternoon. He'd get all sorts of practice using Bellium, and by the time the sun went down, they wouldn't know where he was or where he was going to go next. To make it even more fun, our mysterious friend out there wouldn't know which of these little jumps was the significant one, so he'd almost have to follow along. Carrying that hurricane on his back every step of the way, Kaltan added. Ulath, you're brilliant.
Yes, the blonde-braided Thalesian agreed with becoming modesty.
I know.
I like it, Vanyan approved. What do you think, Sophrenia?
It would give Sparhawk and Bellium the chance to get to know each other, she agreed. And that's basically what we need here. The better they know each other, the better they'll be able to work together. I'm sorry, Sir Ulath. Blurt out conclusions any time you feel like it.
All right, then, Vanyan said in his most businesslike fashion. When Sparhawk's off on one of his little excursions, the rest of us will be sort of invisible. Well, not really invisible, but if Bellium's not with us, our friend won't be able to hear us or feel us, will he?
Probably not, Flute agreed. Even if he could, Sparhawk will be making so much noise that he won't really pay much attention to you.
Good. Let's say that Sparhawk hops up to Darsus and rattles all the windows there. Then he hops back here, picks us up, and puts down in... He frowned at his map. In Siren, on the Senescan border.
He stabbed his finger down on the chart.
Then he hops around to several other places, leaving Bellium and the rings out in the open, so that our friend knows where he is each time. Then he rejoins us at Siren and boxes up Bellium again. By that time, our friend will be so confused he won't know where we are.
Pay close attention, Sparhawk, Kaltan grinned. That's the way a preceptor is supposed to think.
Sparhawk grunted. Then he thought of something.
I want to talk with you for a moment when we leave, he told his blonde friend quietly.
Am I in trouble?
Not yet, but you're working on it.
The slatternly serving girl brought in their meal, glowering at Vanyan as she did, and Sparhawk and his friends began to eat. They did not linger after lunch, but rose immediately and trooped out.
What's your problem? Kaltan asked as he and Sparhawk trailed along behind the others.
Quit trying to get yourself killed.
What are you talking about?
Don't be coy, Kaltan. I saw what you were doing this morning. Don't you realize how transparent you are to people who know you?
You're unwholesomely clever, Sparhawk, the blonde Pandian accused.
It's a character defect of mine. I've got enough to worry about already. Don't add this to it.
It's such a perfect solution. For a non-existent problem, you jackass. Aileen's had her eyes on you ever since we left Kyrellos. She's not going to throw all that effort away. It's you she's after, Kaltan, not Barrett. If you don't stop this nonsense, I'll take you back to Deimos and have you confined in the Mother House.
How do you propose to do that? I've got this blue friend here, remember?
Sparhawk patted the bulge in the front of his tunic.
I can pick you up by the hair, deposit you in Deimos, and be back before Vanyan even gets into his saddle.
That's not fair.
Now you're starting to sound like Talon. I'm not trying to be fair. I'm trying to keep you from killing yourself. I want your oath.
No.
Dimas is nice this time of year. You'll enjoy it. You can spend your days in prayer.
Calton swore at him.
You've got some of the words right, Calton. Now just put them together into a proper oath. Believe me, my friend, you're not going to go one step farther with us until you give me your oath to stop all this nonsense.
I swear, Calton muttered.
Not good enough. Let's make it nice and formal. I wanted to make an impression on you. You've got this tendency to overlook things if they aren't all spelled out.
Do you want me to sign something in my own blood?
Calton demanded acidly.
It's a thought, but I don't have any parchment handy. I'll accept your verbal oath, for the time being. I may change my mind later, though, so keep your veins nice and loose, and your dagger sharp.
Sparhawk? Ambassador Fontaine exclaimed. What are you doing in Darsus?
The ancient Tamil diplomat stared at the big Pandian in astonishment.
Just passing through, Your Excellency, Sparhawk replied. May I come in?
By all means, my boy.
Fontaine opened his door wide, and Sparhawk and Flute entered the crimson-carpeted study of the Tamil Embassy.
You're looking well, Your Royal Highness,
Fontaine smiled at the little girl. Then he looked at her more closely.
I'm sorry,
he apologized to her.
I mistook you for Prince Sparhawk's daughter. You resemble her very much.
We're distantly related, Your Excellency, Flute told him without turning a hair.
Has word reached you about what happened in Mathurian a few weeks ago, Your Excellency?
Sparhawk asked, tucking the bellium back into his inside tunic pocket.
Just yesterday,
Fontaine replied.
Is the Emperor safe?
Sparhawk nodded.
My wife's looking after him. Our time's limited, Your Excellency, so I'm not going to be able to explain everything.
Are you cosmopolitan enough to accept the notion that the Styrix have some very unusual capabilities?
Fontaine smiled faintly.
Prince Sparhawk, a man my age is willing to accept almost anything. After the initial shock of astonishment that comes each morning when I wake up and discover that I'm still alive, I can face the day with an open mind.
Good. My friends and I left Korvan down in Edom about an hour ago. They're riding on toward Siren on the border, but I came here to have a word with you.
An hour ago?
Just take it on faith, Your Excellency, Flute told him. It's one of those Styrix things Sparhawk was talking about.
I'm not certain how much your messenger told you, Sparhawk continued, but it's urgent that all of the Aton garrison commanders in the Empire know that the Ministry of the Interior is not to be trusted. Minister Colada is working for the other side.
I never liked that man,
Fontaine said. He gave Sparhawk a speculative look.
This message is hardly so earth-shaking that it would move you to violate a whole cluster of natural laws, Sparhawk. What are you really doing in Darsus?
Casting false trails, Your Excellency. Our enemies have ways of detecting my presence, so I'm going to give them a presence to detect in assorted corners of the Empire to confuse them a bit.
My friends and I are returning overland from Korvan to Mathurian, and we'd prefer not to be ambushed along the way. This isn't a confidential visit, Ambassador Fontaine. Feel free to let people know that I stopped by. They'll probably know already, but let's confirm it for them.
I like your style, Sparhawk. You'll be crossing Seneska?
Sparhawk nodded.
It's an unpleasant country.
These are unpleasant times. Oh, it won't really hurt if you're sort of smug when you tell people that you've seen me. Our side was definitely behind up until now. That changed a few days ago. Our enemy, whoever he may be, is at a distinct disadvantage right now, and I'd sort of like to grind his face in that fact for a while.
I'll get word to the town crier immediately.
The ancient man squinted up at the ceiling.
How long can you stay?
An hour at the very most.
Plenty of time, then. Why don't we step over to the palace? I'll take you into the throne room, and you can pay your respects to the king, in front of his entire court. That's the best way I know of to let people know you've been here.
I like your style, Your Excellency. Sparhawk grinned. It grew easier each time. At first, Bellium seemed impossibly dense, and Flute frequently had to step in, speaking in that language that Sparhawk strongly suspected was the original tongue of the gods themselves. Gradually, the stone seemed to grasp what was wanted of it. Its compliance was never fully willing, however. It had to be compelled. Sparhawk found that visualizing Vanyan's map helped quite a bit. Once Bellium grasped the fact that the map was no more than a picture of the world, it grew easier for Sparhawk to tell the jewel where he wanted to go. This is not to say that there weren't a few false starts. Once, when he had been concentrating on the town of Dilo, on the east coast, the thought crossed his mind that there was a certain remote similarity between that name and the name of the town of Demos, in east-central Alenia. And after the momentary gray blur where the world around him shifted and changed, he found himself and Flute riding Farron in bright moonlight up the lane that led to Keurig's farm.
"What are you doing?" Flute demanded.
"My attention wandered. Sorry."
"Keep your mind on your work. Bellium's responding to what you're thinking, not what you're saying. It probably doesn't even understand Alenic. But then, who really does?"
"Be nice."
"Take us back immediately."
"Yes, ma'am."
There was that now familiar lurch, and the moonlight faded into gray. Then they were back in bright autumn sunshine, on the road a few miles outside Corvan, and their friends were staring at them in astonishment.
"What went wrong?"
Sophrenia asked Flute.
"Our glorious leader here was wool-gathering,"
Flute replied with heavy sarcasm.
"We just took a little side trip to Demos."
"Demos?" Vanyan exclaimed. "That's on the other side of the world."
"Yes," she agreed. "It's the middle of the night there right now. We were on the road to Keurig's farm. Maybe our stalwart commander here felt lonesome for us ladies cooking."
"I can live without these stalwart commanders and glorious leaders," Sparhawk told her tartly.
"Then do it right."
It came without warning. There was a certain desperation in the flicker of darkness at the edge of Sparhawk's vision this time, and a tinge of harried confusion. Sparhawk did not even stop to think.
"Blue rose,"
he barked to the Bellium, bringing up his other hand so that both rings touched the deep blue petals.
"Destroy that thing!"
He felt a brief jolt in his hands, and heard a sizzling kind of crackle behind him. The shadow that had dogged their steps for so long, which they had thought at first to be Azash, and then the troll gods, gave a shrill shriek and began to babble in agony. Sparhawk saw Sophrenia's eyes widen. The shadow was crying out, not in Zemok or Trollish, but in Styric. Chapter 8.
"Well, now, your queenship," Kalidor was saying, "I don't know as I'd start a dancin' in the streets jist yet. Them fellers over t'interior's been a-doin' everything but a-nailin' the doors shet to keep us from a-puttin' our hands on this yer particular set of files, and now they turns up sort of unexpected-like amongst a whole bunch of others, which I'd swear a oath to that I already looked over about 4 or 5 times my own self. Don't that smell just a bit like a dead fish to you?"
"What did he say?"
Emperor Sarabian asked.
"He's suspicious," Elana translated. "He thinks that our discovery of these files was too easy. He may just have a point."
They had gathered again in the royal apartment, in what was by now generally called Elana's castle, to discuss the surprising discovery of a hitherto missing set of personnel files. The files themselves were stacked in heaps upon the tables and the floor of the main sitting room. "Do you always have to complicate things, Master Kaalador?" The Emperor's expression was slightly pained. As he habitually did now, Sarabian was wearing Western-style clothes. Elana felt that this morning's choice of a black velvet doublet and pearl-gray hose was not a happy one. Black velvet made Sarabian's bronze-tinted skin look sallow and unhealthy. "I'm a professional swindler, Your Majesty,"
Kaalador replied, dropping the dialect. I've learned that when something seems too good to be true, it probably is. Stragan was looking into one of the files.
What an amazing thing, he said. Someone in the Ministry of the Interior seems to have discovered the secret of eternal youth.
Don't be cryptic, Stragan, Aelana told him, adjusting the folds of her blue dressing gown. Say what you mean. He took a sheet of paper out of the file he was holding.
This particular document looks as if it were only written last week, which it probably was. The ink's barely dry.
They are still using those files, my lord, Oscania said, despite the inconvenience. It's probably just a recently filed document. Stragan took out another sheet of paper and handed both documents to the foreign minister.
Do you notice anything unusual about these, Your Excellency?
Oscania shrugged. One of them's fairly new. The others turned yellow with age, and the ink's faded so badly you can hardly read it.
Exactly, Stragan said. Don't you find it just a little odd that the faded one's supposed to be 5 years younger than the fresh one?
Oscania looked more closely at the two sheets of paper. Are you trying to say that they falsified an official document? He exclaimed. That's a capital offense. Let me see those, Sarabian said. Oscania handed him the documents. Oh, yes, Sarabian noted. Kalba. Kolata's been singing his praises for the past 15 years. He held up the suspicious document. This purports to be his appointment to the ministry. It's dated no more than a week after Kolata took office. He looked at Stragan. You think this has been substituted for the original?
It certainly looks that way, Your Majesty.
Sarabian frowned. What could there possibly have been on the original that they'd have wanted to conceal? He asked.
I have no idea, Your Majesty. There must have been something, though.
He leafed through the file.
This Kalba's rise in the ministry was positively meteoric. It looks as if he was getting promoted every time he turned around.
That sounds a bit like the sort of thing one does for a close friend, Oscania mused. Or a relative. Sarabian smiled faintly. Yes, it does, doesn't it? Your brother Itania seems to have risen quite nearly as rapidly. Oscania made a face. That wasn't my idea, Your Majesty. Itania's not a career officer of the Foreign Ministry. I press him into service in emergencies, and he always extorts promotions out of me. I'd rather not have anything to do with him at all, but he's so brilliant that I don't have any choice. My younger brother's intensely competitive, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that he has his eye on my position.
This fallacious document, Stragan found, might give us a place to start, Kaalador mused.
Kaalador frequently dipped in and out of the dialect like a leaping trout. If Kolata took a cluster of friends and relatives into the ministry with him, wouldn't it stand to reason that they'd be the ones he'd trust the most?
It would indeed, Stragan agreed. And we'd be able to tell from the dates on their appointments just who these cronies of his are. And his cronies would have been the people he'd have been most likely to confide in when he decided to take up treason as a hobby. I'd guess that anybody whose appointment coincided with Kolata's elevation to office is probably involved in this business.
The ones is still alive, anyway, Kaalador added. A feller what turns down the chance to join some friends in the treason business ain't got too much in the way of life expectancy after he says no.
May I speak, Your Majesty? Aileen asked Aelana timidly. Of course, dear. The gentle girl was holding one of the files in her hands. Does ink always fade and paper turn yellow as the document gets older? She asked them in a barely audible voice. Indeed it does, child, Sarabian laughed. It drives librarians crazy. And if there was something written down in one of these packages of paper that the people at the inferior ministry didn't want us to... Oscania suddenly howled with laughter. Aileen blushed and lowered her head. I'm just being silly, she said in a very tiny voice. I'm sorry I interrupted. The place is called the Interior Ministry, Aileen, Melodir told her gently. I preferred her term. Oscania chuckled. May I be excused, my queen? Aileen asked, her face flaming with mortification. Of course, dear, Aelana replied sympathetically.
Not just yet, Aelana, Sarabian cut in.
Come here, child, he said to Aileen. She crossed to his chair and curtsied a bit awkwardly. Yes, Your Majesty, she said in a scarcely audible voice. Don't pay any attention to Oscania, he said. His sense of humor gets the best of him sometimes. What were you going to say? It's silly, Your Majesty. I'm just an ignorant girl. I shouldn't have spoken. Aileen, he said very gently, you were the one who suggested that we take all the files of all the ministries out of the government buildings and spread them out on the lawns. That turned out to be an excellent idea. I don't know about these others, but I'll listen to anything you have to say. Please go on. Well, Your Majesty, she said, blushing even harder, as I understand what Milord Stragan just said, those people wanted to hide things that were written down, so they wrote new papers and put them in place of the ones they didn't want us to see. It looks as if that's what they've done, all right. Well, then, if new paper's white and old paper's yellow, wouldn't that sort of mean that anybody whose package has white papers mixed in with yellow ones has something to hide?
Oh, good God!
Stragan exclaimed, smacking himself on the forehead with his open palm.
How could I have been so stupid?
And I went right along with you, Cahalador added. We both walked right over the top of the simplest and most obvious answer. How could we have missed it?
If I wanted to be spiteful, I could say that it was because you're men, Master Cahalador.
Baroness Melodyr smiled sweetly.
And men just adore unnecessary complications. It's not nice to be spiteful, though, so I won't say it.
She gave the two thieves an arch little look.
I may think it, but I won't say it, she added.
It's very easily explained, Your Majesty, Teovin replied calmly. You've already touched on it yourself.
Teovin, the director of the secret police at the Interior Ministry, was a dry, spare sort of man, with no really distinguishing features. He was so ordinary-looking that Aelana felt him to be an almost perfect secret policeman. And what is this brilliant explanation that I've already discovered without even noticing it? Sarabian asked acidly. Teovin held up the yellowed sheet the Emperor had just given him.
As Your Majesty pointed out, the ink on this document has faded rather badly. The information in our files is vital to the security of the Empire, so we can't let time erase the documents. The files are constantly reviewed, and any document that shows signs of approaching illegibility is copied off to preserve it.
Why hasn't that one in your hand been updated then, Teovin? The Emperor asked. It's barely legible.
Teovin coughed diffidently. Budgetary considerations, Your Majesty, he explained. The Chancellery of the Exchequer saw fit to cut our appropriation this year. They're strange over at Exchequer. They always act as if it were their own personal money.
They do, rather, don't they? Sarabian laughed.
The Emperor, Aelana noted, was very fast on his feet, instantly adjusting to surprises.
Chancellor Gashon's hands start to shake every time I start talking about replacing broken tiles in the throne room. I'm glad we had the chance to straighten this out, my friend. I commend you for your devotion to your duty and your concern for the documents which have been placed in your care.
I live but to serve, Your Majesty.
Teovin paused.
I wonder, might I have a word with Interior Minister Kolata? There are some matters, strictly routine, of course, that should be brought to his attention.
Sarabian laughed. Afraid not, old boy, he said easily. You wouldn't be able to keep his attention for very long today.
Oh?
He got some tainted fish at supper last night, and he's been vomiting into a pail since just after midnight. We keep checking the pail, but his toenails haven't come out as yet. Poor Kolata, I can't remember when I've seen a man so sick.
Do you think it's serious, Your Majesty?
Teovin sounded genuinely concerned.
Oh, probably not. We've all come in contact with bad food before, so we know what to expect. He thinks he's going to die, though.
I'd imagine that he rather wishes he could.
We have a physician in attendance. He'll be all right tomorrow, dinner maybe, and a little shaky, but recovered enough to look after business.
Why don't you come by in the morning? I'll make sure that you get in to see him.
As Your Majesty commands, Teovin said, dropping to the floor to formally grovel before the Emperor.
Then he rose to his feet and left the audience chamber. They waited.
He's gone,
Mirtai reported from the doorway. He just went out into the courtyard.
Quick, isn't he? Kaalador noted. He didn't so much as turn a hair when Your Majesty handed him that document.
He was ready for us, Strachan said. He had his story prepared well in advance.
His explanation is plausible, Strachan, Sarabian pointed out.
Of course, Your Majesty. Secret policemen are very creative. We know that Interior Minister Kolat is involved in treason. He wouldn't be much of a threat all by himself, so his entire agency's suspect. We almost have to assume that every department head is involved. As Kaalador so colorfully pointed out, anyone who didn't join in probably got himself defenestrated just as soon as he objected.
The what?
Melodir asked.
Defenestrated. It means getting thrown out of a window. A high one, usually. It doesn't accomplish very much to push somebody out of a ground floor window.
There isn't really such a word, Strachan. You're making it up.
No, honestly, Baroness, he protested. It's a real word. It's a common solution to the problem of politically inconvenient people.
I think we're straying here, Elana told them. Sarabian, why did you make up that story about Kolata and the bad fish?
We don't want his underlings to find out that we're keeping him drugged into insensibility most of the time, do we, Elana?
No, I suppose not. Are you really going to let Teoven in to see him tomorrow?
Maybe we should. We've been stalling Kolata's underlings for 3 days now, and I'm starting to run out of excuses. We'd better let one of them see him, or they'll start to get suspicious.
I'm not sure it's a good idea, but maybe you're right. Aileen, do be a dear and run down to the kitchen. Tell the cooks not to drug Minister Kolata's supper tonight.
Yes, Your Majesty, the girl replied.
You might want to tell them to give him an emetic instead, Strachan suggested.
Why would we want to do that?
Melodir asked.
Emperor Sarabian just told the excellent Teoven that Kolata's been throwing up all day. We wouldn't want people to start accusing His Majesty of lying through his teeth, would we? Minister Kolata should show some signs of illness when Teoven visits him tomorrow. A good, strong emetic should take care of that.
Aileen giggled wickedly. The Royal Princess Danae sat on a divan. She was carefully dressing Myrrh in a new doll's gown. Over the centuries, Afriel had noticed that little Aileen girls did that quite frequently. It didn't really make any sense to the child goddess, but since it was a long-established custom...
Oh, quit, she murmured to her struggling cat. I'm not hurting you.
Myrrh objected loudly, giving vent to a plaintive yowl filled to the brim with a heart-rending self-pity.
Teoven was right about one thing, Strachan was saying to the rest of them.
They had all gathered in the royal apartments again, and the Thalesian thief was holding forth once more. Danae liked Strachan, but the fact that he absolutely adored the sound of his own voice made him a bit tedious at times.
The Ministry of the Interior would die en masse before they destroy a single scrap of paper. The documents they pulled out of those files are somewhere in the building, and those documents would tell us things we haven't even guessed as yet about the conspiracy. I'd give my teeth to get a look at them.
And spoil your smile, Strachan?
Melodir objected.
Bite your tongue.
I was speaking figuratively, of course.
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.